is October the 21st, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it is 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. There's a lawsuit challenging the H-1B wage hikes filed in the U.S. court. The plaintiffs in the case, IT Serve Alliance, an association of IT companies in the United States. This is the first lawsuit challenging the recent wage hikes imposed by the Department of Labor that came into effect on October the 8th. The rules increased the minimal H-1B hike by 50% in some areas. IT firms in the United States filed a lawsuit challenging the U.S. Department of Labor's wage hike rule that increased the H-1B wages up to 50% on October the 16th. The case was filed in the U.S. District Court in New Jersey against the U.S. Labor Secretary and the Assistant Secretary of Labor. The plaintiffs in the case include IT Serve Alliance, an association of IT companies in the United States, and seven other companies. This is the first lawsuit challenging the recent wage hikes imposed by the Department of Labor that came into effect on October the 8th. The rules increased the minimal H-1B hikes by 50% in some areas. The rule was implemented without the notice and public comment period and was effective immediately. Wage hikes were increased by 47% for software developers in Texas, in California, and salary increases for H-1B workers increased by 40%. This increase was across experience levels from entry level to experienced professionals. This would have a huge impact on IT firms because of the increase in wages. The lawsuit said the hikes are contrary to procedures required by law. Department of Labor's issuance of the required notice and comment procedures. The lawsuit further argued that the Department of Labor decision did not consider relevant data, facts, and empirical studies, and failed to engage in reasoned decision-making, and hence was arbitrary and capricious. The lawsuit has asked for a preliminary and permanently enjoined Department of Labor from implementing, applying, or enforcing the rules or any of the prevailing wage methodologies or prevailing wage rates as against plaintiffs and any members of the IT Serve Alliance. Only early in 2020, IT Serve Alliance won a case against the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service that made the Department of Homeland Security rescind two memos that had resulted in increasing denial rates for H-1B. The following is strictly my own editorial comment. Instead of cutting back on the number of H-1B visas granted each year, the Department of Labor did not challenge the need, but requires the company to pay a competitive salary. The H-1B workers were replacing existing U.S. workers, often requiring the displaced workers to train the H-1B replacement worker as a condition of severance. Big tech companies say there is an insufficient number of skilled trained workers. Less than half of STEM graduates each year find work in their related field of study. More than the other half just drift off in unrelated STEM work. The unemployment rate of technical workers is less than 2%. If big tech needs more skilled workers, they have a huge pool of STEM graduates to choose from. Big tech just want only cheap labor. The Apple iPhone announcements were made and Wallet Hub had an iPhone survey. Apple announced four new iPhones last week. Why would Apple announce one new iPhone when they could announce four? Apple announced the iPhone 12 mini, which is a 5.4-inch display with a starting price of $699. The iPhone 12, a 6.1-inch display with a starting price of $799. The iPhone 12 Pro, a 6.1 display with a starting price at $999. And the iPhone 12 Pro Max, a 6.1 display with a starting price at $1099. The cost of the charger is extra. The devices got a little bigger, a little fancier, and a bit more expensive as you go down the line. The big focus here is on improved displays, improved cameras, and the introduction of 5G support across the lineup. All four phones will run on Apple's A14 Bionic chip. Apple also noted that it will continue to sell the iPhone 11, dropping the base price by $100 down to $599. The release of each new iPhone model is a big money occasion for Apple, but this year many people may not have as much money to spend due to COVID-19 pandemic. The unemployment rate is 8.4%, and the total credit card debt stands at nearly $1 trillion, which means that buying a new iPhone is an even bigger decision for consumers than usual. Depending on what features people want, they may have to shell out over $1,000 for a new device. For some people, that's too much. In fact, 36% of Americans plan to reduce the cost of their cell phone as a result of the pandemic, according to a nationally representative survey conducted by WalletHub. However, despite the overall financial outlook, 1 in 3 Americans still plan on getting the new iPhone this year. WalletHub examined not only how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted American cell phone purchase plans, but also why people buy new phones. The report reflects the results of a nationally representative online survey of nearly 450 respondents. The collected responses were normalized by age, gender, and income, so the sample would reflect U.S. demographics. The questions that they asked were, do you plan on purchasing the same iPhone launching later this year? 67% said no. Is a new iPhone worth going into credit card debt? 82% said no. Is a new iPhone a necessity? 72% said no. How would you choose the next iPhone? Well, for those who want to buy an iPhone, 37% says it depends on price. 23% says it's the operating system. 20% says it's the new features. And 20% says it's recommendations and reviews. Are you planning to reduce the cost of your cell phone as a result of the pandemic? 64% said no. Has a pandemic made you want to spend more or less money on your next phone? 70% said less. Should iPhones be used for coronavirus contact tracing? Slightly more than half, 53% said yes. Should Apple charge less for the iPhone due to COVID-19? An overwhelming 73% said yes. Would it bother you if your phone is assembled in China? 61% no. Is your phone your most important belonging during the pandemic? 54% said no. Jill Gonzalez, who is a WalletHub analyst, offers the following advice.
Do you have any advice for saving on a smartphone, considering the fact that 36% of Americans plan to reduce the cost of their cell phone this year? When the iPhone first came out, it was worth getting each new generation of phone because the improvements were so big. Now, there are really only marginal differences with each new model, which means you're better off buying a phone that's at least one generation old. Buying a slightly older phone allows you to have a nearly identical user experience for around half the price. Other ways to save include carrier discounts, along with buying used, good condition phones. With the COVID-19 pandemic continuing to put financial pressure on consumers, it's wise for people to rein in on their spending and put the extra money they would have spent on the latest phone toward other bills. What advice do you have for reducing the cost of wireless coverage, especially during the pandemic? There are many ways to cut down the cost of owning a smartphone while still getting quality coverage, such as shopping around and timing your purchases around good promotional deals. One of the best methods to save money is to get coverage from a budget phone provider that operates on the same network as one of the big brands. Consumers can save a lot of money while having no noticeable difference in coverage. You might also be able to save money by switching to automatic payments or bundling your coverage with a few other people. If you're struggling to pay your cell phone bills due to COVID-19, call your provider and ask if they can offer any temporary relief. Why do almost half of consumers think that their phone is their most important possession during the COVID-19 pandemic? The reason that almost half of consumers think their phone is the most important thing they own during the pandemic is that a cell phone can perform so many crucial functions. A phone can keep people connected to their loved ones during social distancing, order deliveries of food and groceries, facilitate remote work, contact doctors, and help people stay up to date on the latest news. One of the biggest things a cell phone can provide is steady internet access, even without Wi-Fi, which is extremely important for households that don't have any other way to get online. Cell phones are also crucial for contact tracing programs that track the spread of COVID-19.
Yahoo has put the final nail in the coffin for its social media platform, Yahoo Groups, announcing that the 20-year-old service will shut down on December 15, 2020. Yahoo released the following statement. Yahoo Groups, which was aimed to help users stay connected to their community and friends, has seen a steady decline in usage over the last several years. Over that same period, we've witnessed unprecedented levels of engagement across our properties as customers seek out premium, trustworthy content, and to that end, we must sometimes make difficult decisions regarding products that no longer fit our long-term strategy as we hone our focus on other areas of the business. Starting December the 15th, the Yahoo Group's website will be inaccessible, as will its services, including sending and receiving emails. Thank you for helping us build one of the earliest digital communities. We're proud and honored to have forged countless connections over the last 20 years and played a small role in helping build your communities. Yahoo Group, rest in peace. Edge Chromium may have started out as a respectable alternative to Google Chrome on Windows, but it didn't take long for Microsoft to take the shine off the product. Mandatory Windows 10 updates aren't new, but the latest example is raising the ire of the user community. Users are reporting that Windows 10 is forced restarting PCs to install links to Office web apps. The apps take up no storage or other resources. Until now, though, installing Office web apps was optional. Windows isn't asking for your permission, let alone informing you of what's about to happen. Microsoft is potentially disrupting work or other important tasks to promote its online productivity suite. It is installing unrequested Microsoft stuff into your PC without you asking for it. Microsoft stuff onto your PC without you asking for it, of course. While the lack of informed consent is clearly the main issue, this also trivializes mandatory updates. Microsoft instituted them in no small part to ensure users had the latest security fixes and prevent widespread malware outbreaks. If your Windows PC reboots itself to pitch products, you might become wary of those updates or even veer away from Windows altogether. You don't have much control over your system as you might have thought. A late-breaking postscript to Microsoft forcing installation of Microsoft web-based programs. Microsoft has been forced restarting Windows 10 computers to install unwanted web apps. This is the latest proof that you don't own your Windows PC. Microsoft says it was at least partly a mistake, and they will be pausing the migration that brought web apps to your start menu in this manner. Originally, Microsoft said the idea was that any website you pin to the start menu would launch in Microsoft Edge, and it's simply intended to turn those shortcuts into more visible tiles now, but in what Microsoft is calling a bug. The change also turned its existing Microsoft Office web shortcuts into PWA web apps as well. That's something you can normally do from inside the Edge browser, but not something that would happen by itself. But that doesn't actually address any of the concerns that the users have. Why was Microsoft using the Start menu as free advertising for its own Office products to begin with? Why do these shortcuts fire up Microsoft Edge instead of respecting the default choice in the browser? Why does Microsoft believe it has the right to force restart the user's PC at all? Microsoft has clearly heard the user displeasure, and it's reacting to that, but it's not clear whether anything will change as a result. Microsoft is still advertising its own apps in your Start menu, alongside the programs you actually installed. It's giving them premium space in your Start menu without asking. They're still open in Microsoft's own Edge browser, which the company no longer lets you remove, and most annoyingly, the company isn't addressing its practice of force updates and reboots. The Department of Justice has named and charged six men for allegedly carrying out many of the most costly cyber attacks in history. Nearly a half a decade ago, the Russian hackers known as Sandworm hit Western Ukraine with a first-ever cyber attack to cause a blackout, an unprecedented act of cyber war that turned off the lights for a quarter million Ukrainians. They were just getting started. From there, Sandworm embarked on years-long spree and wantonly destructive attacks. There was another blackout attack on the Ukrainian capital of Kiev in 2016. The release of the NotPetya worm in 2017 that spread globally from Ukraine to cause $10 billion in damage, and a cyber attack that temporarily destroyed the IT back end of the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea. Sandworm's members had never been charged or even officially named in connection with those attacks until now. On Monday, the Department of Justice unsealed charges including computer fraud and conspiracy against six of the hackers who allegedly make up Sandworm, a group based in a building in the Moscow suburb. The indictment names all six Russian men who are in their late 20s to early 30s, as well as one who was previously indicted 2 years ago for his alleged role into hacking U.S. states' boards of elections in 2016. Now, however, belatedly, that accountability has arrived for Sandworm's hackers. But as with so many indictments of foreign state-sponsored hackers, the defendants will likely never see the inside of a U.S. courtroom, given the protection by the Russian government. Nonetheless, indictments against foreign hackers limit the ability to use the Western financial system or to travel to any country that may have an extradition agreement with the United States. Last week, I covered the big news of IBM splitting into two companies. Benjamin Rockwell, in his ITM Pro series today, presents his perspective on the IBM split.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. And when I usually say that, I usually follow that up by saying that I've been in the industry for 30 years as an IT professional. But this extends back. What I'm going to talk to you today about extends back beyond my 52 years of life. We go back to 1911, and there was this company by the name of the Computing Tabulating Recording Company, CTR, as they were known. They, in 1924, renamed themselves to International Business Machines, IBM. Now, fast forward to today. Last year, they had over 350,000 employees, and at least 70% of them actually based outside of the United States. Just a few years back, they actually got to the point where over half of their employees were in India. Now, IBM has had a very long storied history, and they've done a number of different things for the information technology community. I'm going to focus on one just for a moment, The IBM personal computer, the Model 5150, that was the original IBM PC, of which we now refer to many of the systems, well, we used to, as PC clones. This was the first computer in the IBM line, and it was what we developed a standard around. Your computer right now, whatever it is that you have, if it is a Windows machine, is derivative of that original machine. There have been incremental improvements along the way, and a lot of them, including the chips are faster and the architecture has slowly evolved, but it's always remained a good bit backwards compatible. And you know, that's kind of the whole story there. IBM has always been really big. In 1984, they were selling twice as many personal computers as Apple. The PC market represented 56% in 1985. Apple, 16%. Now you scratch your head and you think, okay, those are the only two players in the market. Well, there was another player back then. This small little upstart called Tandy Corporation. You may recall them. We referred to them as Radio Shack. But anyways, the whole clone world just took over. And part of IBM's efforts over the years has been to focus on high margin activities. When they developed the personal computer, they had a lot of foresight and in their thoughts, in thinking this is where the world is going to go. Yeah, to some extent, they were still focused over on the business side. They kind of threw the home computer off to the side. They're like, yeah, that's not going to really catch on all that great. They had no idea, but they still went after that high margin activity. Businesses will pay more for computers than, you know, ma and pa. That's just the way it's been. Now, we fast forward to just recently, a couple of weeks ago, and also a year ago, in 2019, rather, they acquired Red Hat. Red Hat, who is that? Well, if you are not familiar with all of the different Linux companies, this was the big one. This is the big, huge Red Hat Linux. It's been around for a long time, and they have gone in the direction of cloud computing. IBM has. Now, what that means is they have high-margin businesses, and they've got lower-margin businesses. Cloud computing is taking off. Cloud computing is one of those things where we know that it's going to eventually be all in the cloud. We're merging there. We've resisted. There is a certain level of negativity that we all have in regards to, I don't want all of my information out there where any hacker can access it. That's another story for another day. But what we've got is their split here is going to move the high margin activities to one side and the low margin activities over to another side. Amongst those low margin activities, Global Technology Services, which is their outsourced arm. This is where all of the different companies, and I think it's like 750 of the Fortune 1000 companies, have some level of interaction with IBM as far as outsourced activities. 90,000 employees work in that outsourced activities. Now, this is big. This is huge. And it represents that next evolution of moving forward for IBM. However, that also means that when you have low margin activities, how do you build up some of these different things? Yes, unfortunately, there are going to be layoffs coming. There are going to be distinct changes in how they do business. And that's unfortunate. I look ahead and I expect that the analysts that are saying about 20% of their workforce, IBM's, you know, new arm, that workforce, are going to be laid off in the coming years. And that's unfortunate. And that's kind of the direction forward in our evolving workplace. You used to be able to go to work for IBM, and yes, you could have a job followed by a pension, and that would take care of you for life. Yeah, not so much anymore. Anywhere. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. IBM spin-off plans to streamline the company. IBM still can't compete against Amazon, Microsoft, or other market leaders in the high-growth public cloud market. So instead of chasing those tech giants, IBM provides hybrid cloud services that help companies process the data that flows between the public and private clouds. Hybrid cloud services are generally popular with large companies that don't want to move all their data onto public clouds yet. IBM's takeover of Red Hat complements those plans. Red Hat software is open source, so it's fully compatible with Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and other leading cloud services. Moreover, the expansion of IBM's ecosystem of hybrid cloud services will feed more data to artificial intelligence services like Watson. Over the long term, IBM believes a hybrid cloud market represents a trillion-dollar market opportunity. IBM expects most of its revenues to come from high-value cloud software and solutions, with more than 50% of its portfolio in recurring revenues. The spun-off company will become the world's leading managed infrastructure service provider, with over 4,600 customers in 115 countries, including more than 75 of the Fortune 100. The slimmed-down company will also focus on managing and modernizing infrastructures with its IT services. The new company will mainly focus on operational efficiency and cash flow generation, which it will prioritize cost-cutting measures, buybacks, and dividends over big investments and acquisitions. The new company would target an investment-grade credit rating, which suggests it could assume more of IBM's debt after the split. IBM's total debt remains manageable and its investment-grade territory. IBM ended the second half of 2020 with $64.7 billion in total debt, down 11% from a year earlier, and it generated a free cash flow of $11.5 billion over the previous 12 months. IBM became a dividend aristocrat of the S&P 500 earlier this year after raising its dividends for the 25th straight year. But the split will end IBM's stint in that elite group, since the two companies will only pay a combined quarterly dividend that is no less than IBM's current dividend, which nets a forward yield of 5.1%. IBM's spinoff could finally clear the road for its cloud and artificial intelligence business to flourish. The standalone IT services company could also become more competitive without IBM's higher growth units constantly sapping away its resources. It's too early to tell if IBM's big split will pay off, but it's better than sitting still and allowing its higher growth cloud and artificial intelligence business to cannibalize its legacy businesses. In the glory days of IBM dominance, the media referred to IBM as IBM and the Seven Dwarfs. The Seven Dwarfs were made up of Burroughs, UNIVAC, NCR, Control Data, Honeywell, RCA, and General Electric. With the advent of the IBM System 360, the number of dwarfs dwindled down to the Bunch, that's B-U-N-C-H, when RCA and General Electric dropped out. The acronym Bunch refers to the first letter of the five remaining companies. Mainframes are used by 71% of Fortune 500 companies. More specifically, they use IBM Z systems. Mainframes handle 68% of the world's production IT workloads. Yet, they account for only 6% of IT costs. Mainframes handle 30 billion business transactions each day. That's a lot of credit card payments, stock trades, and other business-critical transactions. Revenue from the Z system sales increased 62% year over year with the 2019 release of the Z15 system. As these mainframe statistics confirm, mainframe systems are still a vital part of the business landscape. What companies make mainframe computers? Because of the sheer development cost, mainframes are typically manufactured by large companies such as IBM, Amdor, and Hitachi. IBM dominates the mainframe market, accounting for more than 90% market share. Mainframe computers are not disappearing soon. It is said the Triassic period of dinosaurs lasted 52 million years. Science has it wrong. We're still here. Android Auto, Apple CarPlay, and now Alexa Auto Mode for GPS navigation. Global positioning systems were originally created for military use in the 1970s. However, the precursor is the Transit Satellite Navigation System that was first used by the United States Navy in 1965. This system was originally developed to help submarines navigate. The Global Positioning System, which is more commonly known as GPS, is a space-based radio navigation system owned by the U.S. government and operated by the U.S. Air Force. It can pinpoint a three-dimensional position to within 39-inch accuracy and time to 10-nanosecond level worldwide. When GPS service was first made available for civilians in 1983, for national security reasons, the U.S. military decided to scramble the signal, making it a little too inaccurate to be reliable. But then, in 1983, a Soviet Su-15 shot down a Korean passenger jet as it strayed from its intended route into Soviet-prohibited airspace. Realizing worldwide GPS could have prevented the tragedy and could prevent more in the future, President Ronald Reagan opened the system to the public on September 16, 1983. The American taxpayer pays for the GPS service enjoyed throughout the world. All GPS program funding comes from general U.S. tax revenues. The bulk of the program is budgeted through the Department of Defense, which has primary responsibility for developing, acquiring, operating, sustaining, and modernizing GPS. In terms of GPS accuracy in the open sky, there has not been much change in the last few years. If you're outside and you can see the open sky, the GPS accuracy from your phone is about 5 meters, and that's been constant for a while. Back in the days when GPS was not available for automobile use, there would be a collection of maps in the side pocket of an automobile. Unfolding and fumbling with the maps requires someone other than the driver to access directions from the maps. The U.S. government opens contracts with private companies to create portable GPS receivers. GPS company Magellan introduces the first handheld GPS device, the Nav 1000. In 1995, Oldsmobile introduced the first GPS navigation system available in a United States production car, and it was called GuideStar. In their infancy, built-in navigation systems were an expensive option reserved for luxury cars. Today, navigation systems are nearly ubiquitous, even on economy cars. However, prices for factory navigation are all over the map, and there doesn't seem to be any logic to them. Navigation systems start around $500 in new cars, but in most cases, automakers bundle navigation with other accessories and call it a tech or premium package, which can cost more than $4,000 in some luxury vehicles. In some cases, you cannot get a navigation system unless you choose one of the more expensive trim levels. There are now alternative GPS navigations for the car. It first started with the use of portable GPS systems, and in the last few years, it has evolved into the adoption of the smartphone connected to the car infotainment screen for GPS navigation. In May of 2015, which is only 4 or 5 years ago, Hyundai became the first manufacturer to offer Android Auto support, making it available in the 2015 Hyundai Sonata. Today, most automobile manufacturers feature Apple CarPlay and Android Auto GPS navigation. GPS is now almost a standard feature of any new automobile. You only need that one smartphone for whatever you're driving, not one in each vehicle. The software is usually way easier to use than built-in and easier to update. The cost to update the map database on the built-in factory GPS systems costs somewhere between $200 to $400 for replacement DVD, resulting in lag time for updates. Updating the database on a smartphone is often simply a free download. The maps on factory systems are typically as current as the vehicle's model year. If you want to update the maps, you need to purchase a memory card or, for an older vehicle, a DVD. These can cost $75 to $200. It is noted that smartphones already have a map application, and that's all you really need. The quality of the maps from Apple and Google are quite good for most people. For many cities, the fastest way to get from A to B isn't necessarily the shortest path. It's the one with the least traffic. Smartphone apps have excellent traffic data and access to the phone app Waze, that's W-A-Z-E, the community-based traffic app. Factory systems may have live data, but you have to pay for a subscription once the trial has ended. Smartphone maps will never be out of date, and any updates are always included. The same goes for the names and addresses of any points of interest you want to visit. Smartphones let you input an address as you walk to the car, leverage your contacts for their addresses, have a calendar app to remind you that you need to leave at a certain time, and then route you there. All those things happen in a faster interface with typing that's easier than the input method required by other systems. If you have an older car without the option to connect your smartphone, you can still use your phone for GPS navigation. You can purchase a car mount for the phone, and it will most likely sit in a cup holder. The mount itself can cost from $20 for a basic unit to $100 for a do-it-all mount that would charge the phone and boost the audio and GPS signal. Most of the native map applications rely on a cell signal for their map data. If you lose cellular coverage, you may find yourself unable to use the maps and directions. Apple and Google offer the ability to download certain maps for offline use. Right now, the modern experience behind the wheel comes down to just two choices, namely Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. But without a doubt, using Android Auto and Apple CarPlay is for most people out there a natural thing to do, as the two come bundled with their phones, and theoretically, simply pairing the mobile devices with the head units should be enough to run them. But, and there's a big but, Amazon hopes that you'll soon give a try for Alexa. The company has revamped its mobile app for Android Auto and Apple CarPlay with a massive update specifically aimed at drivers. It's more of an alternative to Android Auto for phones, and there's no doubt that Amazon is already exploring the ways it can bring this experience to the larger screen inside the car. Alexa now sports a so-called auto mode that comprises four different screens, each with a very straightforward role. First of all, it's the home screen, which provides access to frequent actions, shortcuts to play and pause music, navigate to home or work, and start a call. All options are displayed with touch-optimized layout, and they can also be controlled with voice. The bar at the bottom of the screen lets you switch to the second page, which is called Navigate, and allows you to use your preferred app, be it Google Maps, Apple Maps, or Waze, to get directions to a specific location. Of course, you can use voice input to ask Alexa to run the app and set up navigation, but also to look for new places nearby. Then the third screen is called Communicate, and makes it possible to start a call, configure a drop-in for Amazon, or make an announcement to one of your contacts. Everything works the same, either with touch input or voice commands. And last but not least, it's the play screen that comes down to the music player, and Alexa again offers a touch-optimized interface with voice support, allowing you to control the playback wirelessly. Everything has been designed to be easy to use while driving and to reduce distraction, and in many ways it looks and feels just like Android Auto for phones, only that Alexa is now at the core of everything. The new auto mode is live in just a series of countries for now, including the United States, United Kingdom, France, Spain, Italy, and Germany. Alexa is also getting a second feature called Start My Commute, only in the United States this time, which allows the app to run a user-defined routine that can include playing your music, speaking the news, getting traffic updates, or hearing the weather forecast, or by saying, Alexa, start my commute. Well, what can we expect next? Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation. Marty Winston dives deeper into physics-based water conditioning, shares some field results from real fields, and tells us a new consumer-facing product line in his segment called Splash Tech.
A few weeks ago, in a segment titled Water, Shaken, Not Stirred, the subject was how physics can condition water. That report, it turns out, was incomplete, but you deserve a short, simple recap of the first part, plus something not in the first part about another well-known physical force also playing a role. But the theory is just the beginning. In this segment, Splash Tech, you'll learn about some unexpected bonuses that emerge from this approach to conditioning. Beyond residential, beyond just living the rest of your life without lugging any more big heavy bags of water softening pellets, well, some of those bonus effects work on a much larger scale, and real reports from real users provide some knockout paybacks from this tech. Before you leave, the focus will come home again to a new line of products just launching that cuts the cost of physics-based water conditioning in the home. Some of them don't even need a plumber to get installed. But let's start with magnets and the Faraday effect, which says that an electrical charge results from moving anything conductive through changing magnetic fields. Down at a molecular level, everything that's dissolved in the water and everything that's just along for the ride picks up those charges. That gets them into an attract-repel spin fest, and they churn themselves into tinier pieces. The long molecules, the long structures, the flake shapes, all of those get broken up, shaken apart. Then they bump into each other, like a pre-pandemic mosh pit date night, and they hook up and bond. Instead of little molecular structures in the water, they cluster into bigger clumps, bigger enough to bounce off pipe walls instead of sticking to them and clogging up the pipes. The part you didn't hear about is a centrifuge effect. The flow-through paths in these magnetic conditioning products have spiral grooves inside, called rifling, if you know that term, and there's a slight inward taper in the direction of the flow. That taper builds pressure. The rifling makes the water swirl into a vortex, and the spinning works like a centrifuge. Heavier stuff, meaning denser stuff, gets separated from lighter stuff. But there's nothing dissolved in the water anymore. The water is all water, only water, with everything else. Well, everything else goes swimming in their own lanes. Our first round did mention the Moses effect. Water exposed to supermagnet fields has a very much reduced coefficient of friction at its surface. It moves through the pipes more easily. Now, reporters early on learn to never accept statements about products or results without looking deeper. So far, the most sophisticated physical water conditioning products we've seen are from a California company named Magnation. They've been making them for about 12 years. They mostly sell to farms, to factories, and to other commercial and industrial users. So, ignoring for the moment what Magnation has to say about their products, here's some of what's getting reported by their users. At Tyson Foods, they use 5 million gallons of water per day and pump it through 10 miles of pipe. Before Magnation, they were cleaning half an inch of limescale from their pick heater every day. That cleanup downtime costs the company $6,000 per minute. That's $100 per second in lost production. A big Magnation product called the Turbulator didn't completely eliminate the scale buildup at Tyson, but now it's soft and powdery. So it's quicker and easier to clean, and Tyson only has to do that once every 3 days. For Tyson, that's not chicken feed. It comes out to a savings of more than $1 million a year. At the 5-story headquarters building for The Gap, where the source water is extremely hard and has challenges like high pH and a lot of dissolved solids, magnesium conditioning helped neutralize the pH, reduce total dissolved solids, eliminate chemical treatments, fight scaling, and here's that Moses effect, save them 42% in the cost of energy to pump the water. When there's less water friction against the pipes, pumping the water needs less power to make it happen. A California municipality with school and public fields to water was able to use 50% less water and to increase their water retention by 251% just by conditioning the water with physics-based products from Magnation. A farm in Nebraska with corn, soy, and other crops reports boosting their crop yield by, get this, 48 more bushels per acre while using a full one-third, 33% less water to grow them. An Idaho potato farm was able to get a healthier crop despite cutting back on watering by 2 inches. Dick's Sporting Goods installed Magnation on half their fields and saved 6.5 million gallons in 1 year. Yes, that was a test. Yes. Oh, boy. Magnation passed. 25% savings in the electric power needs for pumping. 25% savings in the water needed for irrigation to reach hydration targets. The same kinds of results from every corner. Scale deposits reduced or eliminated. Less water needed for healthier crops. More crops per acre. Less power needed to pump the same volume of water. Faster germination. More seed growth. Better roots. Reduced soil salinity. Improved soil permeability. Increased dairy milk production per cow. More growth for piglets. Larger chickens with better meat to fat ratios. All of that from using magnets, the Faraday effect, the Moses effect, and the centrifuge effect to condition water. Not soften it, condition it. I think you can see why I find physics-based water conditioning so impressive, so intriguing. But what about softening? Does your house have that big brine tank that you fill with bags and bags of salt pellets? Ask most people why that's there, and they'll talk about cutting down on lime scale and about getting better suds and lather when washing. Would Magnation technology have the same result on a residential level? Well, their gear is here. It does stop scale, but does it without eliminating the calcium that's so good for bones and teeth. It does make good suds and lather. It does neutralize pH. It does help the water flow a little faster and taste a little better. Well, come on over. Bring your own glass or bottle and try some. But gang, you know me. I'm not bashful. I went head-to-head with the owners at Magnation and insisted they come out with a consumer residential line of products. And this week, the first of those is shipping. And no, they don't pay me a commission if you decide to buy them. The new line uses Magnation water technology, but it's under a new brand name, Water Tamer. The website is tameyourwater.com. There are two whole house conditioners that you can install without using a plumber. One is a strap-on product called Trifecta, and the other is, well, it works like a strap bracelet. It's a strip of magnets that spirals around the incoming water pipe and stays there. That's called Klingon. Kling with a C and a hyphen in the middle. Klingon. As soon as they're on, they're working. No power, no consumables to resupply. They just start working and keep working. There are two models a plumber can install, and these add the centrifuge effect. One of them, Model R for residential, is a single stage. The other, called Triple Play, has two of those Model R units with a vortex-enhancing internally finned pipe between them. They also have a Model O for outdoors, and you just put that in line with your watering hose or your sprinkler. Or a Model S. S is for showers. You can just add that right before your shower head. You don't need a plumber for those two. Does your house need a sediment trap? Most houses on wells do. If you're tired of replacing the filters in those sediment traps, the Water Tamer Crud Tamer uses an array of internal discs those are inside, to stop crud down to 5 microns, and you never have to replace them. There's a built-in backflush mechanism to keep them clean. And for you gourmets, a little funnel with a long name. Good gracious, that's Magnatius. Well, that little funnel changes the water you pour through it for smoother texture and fuller flavors because it's wide open. It becomes wide open to dissolving whatever you use to cook or make drinks, even just coffee or tea. The only thing you ever pour through it is water. It's really cool. And all of this because at a molecular level of the shake, rattle, and roll of magnetic conditioning, plus the twist and shout of the centrifuge effect. Good old physics. Always liked it more than chemistry. Next time, just ahead of Halloween. Well, we might normally do scary stories, but it's 2020 and we deal with enough of those in the news every day. Still, have you noticed how much tech has become a crutch and maybe an addiction? Are we its masters or its prisoners? And if we leave it behind, where does that leave us? Be here for the segment we'll call Tech or Treat. Don't miss it, or I'll have to hack your pumpkin.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on what's new and improved in iOS 14 and iPadOS 14. Thursday, October the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is pcug.com. Princeton PC Users Group will meet Tuesday, October the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom video conference, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, November the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 13th. Starting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. On the Internet, podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.